Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. So Christmas is coming up. One way you know that is obviously by all the lights and the decorations around. You also know it by the fact that 24 hours a day, maybe 25 hours a day, since Thanksgiving, they've been playing every Christmas carol on earth everywhere. There's nowhere you can go. You are not safe from Christmas. I walked into Gary Knoll's building here today and into the studio, and I did not hear Christmas carols. But if I hear a Christmas carol, I'm walking out, so it'll be a two-minute show. And see, now this is it. Because I'm talking to somebody out there in the pastor window who's perverse, he may actually put a Christmas carol on. But I knew he was thinking that, but I hope he doesn't do it. You know, because he's a decent guy. Otherwise, I'd have to forgive him. And that's what Christ was all about, right? Meanwhile, that's all you hear 24 hours a day. And every year I get sick of one particular one more than any other one. But I think after all the years of listening to these things, I don't know why, and there's nowhere you can go. Banks, doctor's offices, apartment buildings, any kind of building, lobbies, elevators. They even put one in my building. You know, I mean, you walk around all day long in Manhattan, and you hear it everywhere, you know. Rudolph, the Red, no, blah, and Frosty, the Snowman, blah, 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 till you want to throw up. You want to puke, right? I mean, it's disgusting. I don't know why they do this. Why do they do it? It's some kind of hypnotic trance that everybody goes into. Do people think that's going to make people buy? There's no place like home for the holidays? Really? Well, that's true. There is no place like home for the holidays, but not in the way that I suppose this song means. But do they imagine that these songs who plays all these songs? This is done because other people did it. It's done because every year somebody else did it. It's like lemmings jumping off a cliff. It really is. The stupidest Christmas carol there is. I don't know who wrote it. By the way, most of these Christmas carols, like I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, was written by Irving Berlin, a Jew who escaped Russia, where his town was burned down by Cossacks, who comes to New York City and, you know, lives this awful, hard life on the Lower East Side. And then he's dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones he used to know. Yeah, back in Russia, where the pogroms were happening, right? Is that the ones he's remembering? It doesn't make any difference. I think half these Christmas carols, you know, like there's no place, you know, have a Merry, Merry Christmas or whatever it is, or all written by Jews probably in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s on Tin Pan Alley someplace. So, going out to lunch and having four scotches and a corned beef sandwich and coming back and writing, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. I don't know. The stupidest Christmas carol there is have a holly jolly Christmas. What does that even mean? I mean, some of these, all right, enough. All right. I have to stop this. But every year they play these things. What is it? What is the point except to make you feel disgusted, ill, and irritated all the time? After a while, of course, you tune it out if you want to escape the feeling of irritation and, you know, like a feeling like you've just eaten too much and you want to, you know, get rid of it. You tune it out. But that's not good either, because it's just one more thing that you tune out in the modern world. It's more noise that you tune out. We spend so much time tuning everything out, all the noise and all the graphics and all the crap that's in your face and in your ears and your eyes. We so much time tuning things out that we tune out. It's like the baby in the bathwater. We tune out humanity at the same time we're tuning out everything else. You have to. You can't take a cherry-picking approach to what you tune out. You walk, and this is at least, I'm talking about Manhattan here. I mean, if you live in a country or you live in a quieter place, which God love you if you do, right? You know, God bless you if you do. But if you live in Manhattan like I do, and you don't have the money or the, I don't know what, the courage or the willpower to relocate yourself like me, you learn to walk the streets with the millions of people and all the noise and all the graphics and everything and all the bus billboards and everything, and you tune it all out. But you're also tuning other people out at the same time. It's a numbing experience. Meanwhile, Christmas is coming, the birth of Jesus, the Prince of Peace, right? The man of peace and love. What became of Christianity after Jesus? I mean, after there are some seeds in some of the things Jesus said, you know. He was making it pretty clear, I think, in some of the things he said in the New Testament, that in the Gospels. And who knows, you know, about the Gospels, right? Reported by people, written down by people. We don't know exactly who they were. We don't know when they did it. But it wasn't, I think most of the Gospels were not written during you know, the first 100 years after Jesus died. So, I don't know who wrote the Gospels, but most of it is about forgiveness. It's about peace. It's about love, and it's about forgiveness and turning the other cheek and treating either other people equally. And this was a revolutionary idea at the time. Now, whether or not, do I believe Jesus was the Son of God? No, I don't believe he was the Son of God. I believe I'm the Son of God. So there's no, and there's only, and you know, there's only one, there's only room for one, right? You know, I mean, I have a lot of, I have sisters, so there's a lot of daughters of God, but obviously there are people who believe that they're Son of God. What's his name? Kim Jong, I forget, get confused with his father. Kim Jong-un, Il, or is it, it's Un, the kid is Kim Jong-un. And he and his pals apparently have decided to hack Sony Pictures. And he clearly believes he's the Son of God. You know, I mean, the dictatorship is it's a long line of King Kim Jong-ims or whatever. It's gone to his head. I mean, he believes he is the probably, an inherited monarch from whatever strange world he comes from. But the Son of God, do I believe Jesus was the Son of God? No, I do not believe Jesus was the Son of God. Do I believe that there may have been a Jesus walking around on earth that had a message of peace and was a kind of a revolutionary for the time? Yeah, sure. It's perfectly possible. That's only 2,000 years ago. We have verifiable history of, of famous people from, way before him, of Buddha, of Plato, of Aristotle. I mean, there, there's plenty of people, of various Roman emperors and maybe Alexander the Great. There's all kinds of verifiable history. And so it's relatively recent history, 2,000 years ago, that that Jesus could have actually been a real person who was walking around Palestine, the Holy Land, and preaching a gospel of love and peace and forgiveness. The idea that you could only be saved, that you can only enter the kingdom of heaven through him, the kingdom of heaven being an interesting thing. I mean, the kingdom of heaven was obviously what he meant, as far as I'm concerned, was the kingdom of heaven right here, right now, right here, right? The kingdom of heaven. And some paradise when you die that you go to and you fly around with wings or virgins feed you grapes or whatever it is, or, chocolates or Godiva chocolates, whatever they have in various kinds of heavens. I don't think the Jews have a heaven. Do the Jews have a heaven? I don't think so. Would you go to heaven? Is there a heaven for Jews? You go up and you have matzo ball soup forever, and you have corned beef. And of course, if you're anti-Semitic, the Jews go to heaven and they make big deals cheating other people, and they unite international banking in heaven. What is the Jews' heaven? I don't really know. I don't. The Diamond District, right. The Jews' heaven is 47th Street. It's like you can never leave. You're walking. Well, that sounds like hell, actually. If you ever walk down, there's a place in New York City. It's actually a street, 47th Street, between 5th and 6th Avenue, which is the diamond center of New York and the diamond center of the country and one of the big diamond centers of the whole world. And it's entirely, I would say, 99.9% run by Jews, Israeli Jews, and American Jews. And it's just a business they all went into. This goes back hundreds of years and involves complicated history having to do with Amsterdam, where diamonds pass through. And it's a very strange, complex, sometimes sordid history. And it has to do with South Africa, where there was a lot of Jews, where there's a lot of diamonds. So can't get into that right now, but I don't know that for some people that might be the heaven that they aspire to is great business deals. I don't know. In other places, maybe it's just celebrating God, and this goes not just for Jews but for anybody. Like the whole idea of I have Jewish friends whose idea of heaven would be that, and on earth, heaven on earth, right? If they could just study the Talmud. If they spend all day long not having to work, not having to deal with other responsibilities, just sit and study. And there are Jews who do that. There are Jews, religious Jews, who do that. And it's considered a holy occupation. It's considered an elevated, transcendent occupation. Am I all over the place this morning? Yeah, I'm all over the place today. It's Jesus' birthday coming up. And that is on Thursday. Is it Thursday? Yeah, it's Thursday. And I was thinking about this, and he really, Jesus, if, to the extent you believe in him or his message, the message that we have from him, and I treat Jesus like a lot of mythology, like it's not, or even other religions. There may have been an actual Mohammed. There may have been an actual Moses. There may have been an actual Jesus. Maybe there very well was. I don't really know. But what comes down to is what is valuable, what is remaining of it, is a lot of this is contained in the various holy books, and there may have, and Buddha too, right? Are the moral and philosophical lessons, and the lessons on how to live in the world how to deal with suffering, how to deal with pain, how to deal with mortality, how to deal with life every day, from day to day. That's what we concentrate on. And we isolate out the message. And the message in this case is to love other people, to not respond to violence and insult and arrogance and ill treatment and contempt with the same emotions and with the same behavior. That is, let me have a little water here. And that is the message, is to stop the cycle, stop this endless retributional cycle of violence, hatred, and contempt. So, oh, don't let me forget my water bottle, all right? Yeah, okay. Well, sometimes I bring my water bottle here to the studio and I leave it, and then I'm all for blunged after that. I cannot, which is it's an ancient Latin word for all, you know, all messed up. So I have to have my water, my bottle. I have to have my body, you know, my little bottle, or else I feel lost. So I left it here at the studio last week. What comes down to us are these messages. And his message for the time that he was living in, which was a harsh time, you know, his country was occupied by the Romans, possibly along with the Nazis and some other people, the biggest hard-ons that ever lived in the world, right? Who valued toughness and pitilessness, who valued macho manhood. These guys were testosterone times testosterone times a quantum, you know, amount of testosterone, these guys. The Romans, the original tough guys. And they occupied Palestine. And not to trivialize or to reduce the entire Jewish Bible into, you know, little phrases or something, you know, the Old Testament. The prevailing feeling in the Middle East those days was, although it was being altered somewhat, was it's a harsh place, the Middle East. It's a place of where there were desert religions, the desert and rocky places. And it was not a, I mean, there were places that were green and they were beautiful, you know, in the Middle East, obviously. But a lot of it was desert and hard scrabble rock. It was a hard environment, a hard place, hot and hard and dry in a lot of places. Although there were, you know, oases of green and, you know, growths of olive trees and all kind of, you know, orange trees. But it was a harsh, generally a harsh place, and it was a place of tribal warfare, even between, you know, people who claim to have the same religion. And it was a place of, like every place has always been, of class. You know, there were people who were, in the case of the Jews in the in Palestine at the time, it was the high priests and some people who had money. And so they were at the top, and what's new, right? And then the lower people, the lower classes, were the people who worked every day, you know, except for the Sabbath. hard scrabble working people, you know, people who put, you know, tilled what the earth was and, you know, whatever it had available. So it was a tough place. It was a tough place to live, and the Romans are occupying it, and they're crucifying anybody who got out of line, who didn't pay their taxes. It was a hard time, and it was a time of an eye for an eye. This is a tribal desert place, a time for an eye for an eye. That was the kind of punishment that we're talking about. And that hasn't gone away, of course. We still, a lot of us, believe in the world in an eye for an eye, especially people, I have to say it appears to be, especially people in the Middle East who still believe in an eye for an eye. There is no giving up your right to revenge. It's a harsh, violent, primitive place. Will that ever change? I have no idea. I have no idea if it will ever change. But the message of Jesus was revolutionary at the time. It was absolutely revolutionary. I suppose the message of Buddha also was revolutionary at the time. There is some speculation that Jesus, there are some missing years not accounted for in his life, that he may have traveled far to the east and encountered Buddhism, encountered the concept and the principle of Buddhism. But before he went on his mission at the age of 33. But it was revolutionary. The idea of not cherishing revenge, of not spending your life in hatred and get back, you know, and payback. You don't hold on to it. That was the idea. And he was considered to be, you know, he let people think he was the Messiah. Personally, I think that was public relations. You know, people said, somebody said, what is one of his acolytes said to him, one of his disciples said to him, are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? And he said, what do people say? Or what do you think? He didn't say, yes, I am. He said, what do people say? Or what do you think? And he allowed them to believe that he was. But forget about the Son of God stuff. I mean, basically, you're dealing with a God. Also, he was the son of a God who might have been disappointed in him. You're talking about Yahweh here. You're talking about tough guys. Yahweh in the Old Testament, especially the older parts of the Old Testament, when he didn't get, I mean, this is a desert religion. When he didn't get his way, Yahweh, boom, thunder and lightning and earthquakes and plagues. And you do not mess with Yahweh, right? So he was a big old tough guy, a real hard character, right? If Jesus was his son, he might have been pretty disappointed in Jesus. It was like, let's say, like a football coach, you know, some really tough football coach, like Vince Lombardi, you know, from the old days, or some really tough football coach having a son who wanted to be a ballerina and who was gay and who was a vegan. You know, this Yahweh could not have been but disappointed in Jesus if he was really his son. So I don't even know if they were talking to each other. You know, maybe Yahweh threw Jesus out of the house. Said, you know, no son of mine. You want to watch football this Sunday? No, Dad. It's so brutal and it's so rough and people are hitting each other. I think what I'm going to go out is like, I'm going to make like a little dresser, or maybe I'm going to make some tables or something, you know, shades of Mel Brooks. You know, I like the carpentry stuff. You know, I get to work with my hands. I just don't like guys hitting each other. Well, you know what? You know, I hate to say it, but I can't believe that I'd see the day when some son of mine turned into a faggot, you know? I mean, give me a break, will you? If he was the son of God, things might not have been too good between the two of them. I didn't mean to turn into Shecky Green here this morning, but whatever comes out, right? So meanwhile, you got Jesus coming up. And the point being, the bottom line after all my meandering around here was that his message in this harsh desert tribal place with ancient traditions of stoning women who had committed adultery, even if there was no proof, or if there was proof, stoning women to death. This kind of punishment, you know, an eye for an eye, a hand for a hand, just cut off. Ancient grudges, retribution, murder, revolution. Sometimes you have to have a revolution. Sometimes there has to be fire in the lake. There does. There has to be revolution. But still, to run a society every day based on, and who am I to say? I didn't live then. I didn't know what it was like. You know, life was hard. Life was tough. But to cherish these ancient tribal and familial, you know, grudges, which result in an endless cycle of violence, was a new message. But, you know, this kind of thing still prevails. Look what happened in Pakistan the other day. I don't know how much of this I can read, how my throat can handle it, but it says here, Peshawar, Pakistan. As Pakistani Taliban gunmen strode through the corridors and classrooms of the Army Public School on Tuesday, spraying teachers and pupils with bullets, spraying, kind of a silly word, cutting down teachers and pupils with bullets, one paused from his grisly work to make a phone call. quote, "We have killed all of the children in the auditorium," the militant, later identified by the military as Abu Zar, told his handler. "What do we do now?" And the answer came, "Wait for the army to arrive, kill them, then blow yourself up." I would love to know who he called. I'd love to know who he called. As crazy and as psychotic as whoever, as Mr. Abu Zar was, and his eight buddies who killed all these people, most of them children. It was 145 people and I think 132 children. He murdered innocent people and he murdered children, all of them, the nine lunatics. That conversation that he had with the person who told them to kill them and blow themselves up, which is exactly what they did, by the way. They waited for the army to come. They killed as many as possible, then blew themselves up and took some of the army with them. That conversation recounted by a senior security official who said it had been intercepted by Pakistani intelligence offered sobering proof of the methodical approach and cold resolve of the Taliban militants who, over the course of an eight-hour rampage, here it is, killed 148 people in the school and at least 132 children. Let's see. At the school, army officials led the way to the principal's office, which was destroyed on Wednesday. The room was devastated, streaked with blast marks and blood torn by a suicide bomber's blast. Military officials said they believed the principal, Tahiri Kazi, a woman, had died trying to save her students. The bodies of two boys were also found in the office. Children. Let me say it again. Children. Right? Do you have children? I have children. But elsewhere in the school complex, four main buildings clustered around a central administration block, it was the blood of children that dominated. It was everywhere, smeared on the walls, pooled in the corridors, soaked in abandoned clothes. The smell of explosives and charred flesh filled the air. The greatest carnage occurred inside the assembly hall, where soldiers said they had recovered over 100 bodies, many piled on top of each other. Shoes, copybooks, and spectacles were scattered amid empty rows of seats where, according to witness accounts, students had cowered in a vain attempt to evade the killers. They were singled out, the children, one by one, and shot in the head. Some teachers tried to intervene. An army officer was giving first aid lessons on the main stage of the auditorium when the gunman burst in. A female teacher, officer said, had begged the gunman to let the children go. She was also executed. The militant rampage was cut short, officials said, when commandos, et cetera, et cetera. And that's when they blew themselves up and killed some of the soldiers. This is, where is Jesus and his message? Right now, I'm looking for Jesus right now. You know, Jesus is going to come when the time is right, according to the Bible. You know, this has to be, we have to have the sign of this and the sign of that, and there has to be a toppling of the rending of the veil of the temple, and there have to be, you know, yellow and black and green locusts, you know, dancing the hula, you know. I mean, it's laid out in the Bible, you know, the seven signs and the seals of the book have to be opened, blah, 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 blah. Forget about it. Forget about it. We need you right now, babe. If you have a message of peace in this world where there are bombings and tortures and executions and people are blowing people up and people are killing children, executing children. And there is a lot of, seems to me, there's a lot of, obviously a lot of condemnation, and you're getting some of it from me too, I guess. But I'm more sort of just in a state of melancholy, despair, and awe about all this. Not condemning, although I suppose I should be condemning, but no one really has the right to be condemning. No government has the right to be condemning. I mean, the United States, how many children died in Hiroshima? Totally unnecessary, right? Well, I mean, if you ask people after World War II, they wouldn't say it was so unnecessary. I mean, but they couldn't find military targets to blow up. There were none left whatsoever. You had to drop a bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Probably 20,000 children got killed or mutilated or damaged beyond repair. What about the firebombing of Dresden in Germany? As if that would make any difference to a lunatic like Hitler that Dresden got blown up. the British and the American Air Force firebombed Dresden, and how many thousands of children were murdered at that time. But of course, what makes this more cold-blooded, people say, is that these men went there deliberately to went to a school. Where who were they going to find? They were going to find children, and they murdered them. They didn't just shoot them down, you know. They didn't just spray bullets, but they also sought them out when they were hiding and put a bullet in their head. The last time you read about something like this is the Nazis. Yes, the Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq have killed a lot of children. One way or another, they've killed a lot of children. The American government has killed a lot of children in Afghanistan and Iraq. Sometimes they say by accident. Well, it's not by accident if you're in a place where you don't belong in the first place. But it's this crazy vengeance. And a lot of it, I have to say, it's not just isolated to the Middle Eastern countries. But right now, right here, right now, the kind of executions and murder and vengeance and deliberate blowing up of innocent people and murdering of children and innocent women and men in mosques and in marketplaces. The Middle East and I have to say, the Muslims have a corner on this market right now. And this is not excusing the Americans' behavior all over the world. I mean, I've been over this a million times. I'm not excusing it. But this kind of insane murder where children are the victims of it, it is part, I think, of an ancient... And how much of this has to do with religion? Very, very little. This has to do with tribalism, with revenge, with testosterone, with men out of control, with patriarchies, with patriarchies. I don't believe any of this, or very little of this, has to do with religion. But some craziness, something gets in the blood of people, and obviously certain people more than other people, and they kill on purpose the most innocent people they can find. This is what happens. And it's a cycle of revenge and murder that you just wish somehow it would stop, but it never seems to stop. How much time do we have left? Yeah, okay. You wish it would stop, but it doesn't seem to want to stop, and it's never going to stop. I mean, the Taliban said that they were just getting even for the Pakistani Air Force and the American Air Force, especially the Pakistani Air Force and Pakistani Army, killing people in Waziristan, where the tribal areas where the Pakistani Taliban lived. They were just getting even for it. So, is this ever going to stop? Is this crazy cycle ever going to stop? Because there's something in the blood, this macho-ness, this testosterone that never, absolutely never seems to stop.
برا الحزن البغض والزوارة
You know, I have no idea what that guy was saying. I don't know what he was saying. I presume that's Arabic, but I have no idea what he was saying. I picked that song because it's got that crazy masculine frenzy in it. And you could hear the same thing if you play the song of the Panzers, you know, the Deutschland über alles. There's Scottish music, you know, war music. War music in every place with the drums, you know, and the that heavy beat and that pounding. There's something testicularly insane about it that infuses the blood of a lot of people. And I have a friend who told me many years ago, and I was sort of surprised to hear it. You know, I wanted to go. I said, let's go to the St. Patrick's Day parade and hear the the music. Let's hear the drums, you know. And he says, I hate military music. This is a guy like me who graduated from the 60s, right, who was into protests and demonstrations, and a guy not untough in his own way. But he said, I hate military music. He said, what do you get out of that? You know, I don't know. I mean, when you were just listening to that, I would be interested to hear how women reacted to that music and how men reacted to that music. A lot of rock and roll is like that. I mean, I like, who's my favorite rock and roll group? The Rolling Stones, you know, because I'm old, right? I mean, you know, I'm sure that there was rock and roll after 1980. But so that's in the last 34 years, maybe, Mr. Engineer, has there been rock and roll in the last 34 years? Oh, come on, not good, really? Well, I wouldn't. There's some good stuff. I wouldn't really know. But my favorite group, even the new stuff I've heard, is the Rolling Stones. Because it's tough guy music, because it's testosterone music. So I have to confess to being that way myself. I am not a Buddhist, and I am not somebody who, now in my old age when I'm mellow and I'm slowed down and there's not much I can do about it, and I lost a lot of my strength, you know, I am willing to turn the other cheek. But when I was capable of doing a lot more than that, I was not willing to do it. I had this thing that comes in. This is the way most men are, or a lot of men are, that when somebody gets in their face, when somebody wrongs them, when somebody, especially physically, you can watch a football game and you could see this, or a hockey game or something like that. This is where it's still played out. And, of course, people who make a career out of the Army, you know, the Navy SEALs and people like that. It's where getting even. It's where violence. It's where murder is the normal thing to do. It's only right. It's only natural. And sometimes you have to wonder, with Christmas coming up and the message of Jesus being, and now Jesus was a man, right? He wasn't a tall white man with blue eyes, like a lot of people in this country believe he was. He was probably a relatively short, darkish-skinned Jewish man, you know, who could have looked like an Arab or a Middle Eastern Jew from a long time ago. But be that as it may, so it's his birthday is coming up, and I remember in the '60s there was this really dramatic standoff where a lot of hippies, a lot of boys and young men let their hair grow long. And they didn't have that military haircut anymore, that crew cut, that tough guy look. They weren't interested in building up their muscles. They didn't do work. Some of them didn't work at all. But they didn't do work necessarily where they were strong and tough. And it was always a standoff when we went on demonstrations. I didn't have my hair long because I was probably too prudish. I might have wanted it long, but it was curly. I had a mustache. You know, I didn't really look like a real tough American guy. But there was these standoffs, and they would get violent from one side. The hard hats, all these guys would come out, construction workers, a lot of them, and they would throw bricks at us or whatever was handy at the construction site that they didn't need, like tools. But they would throw bricks at us. I mean, people got really hurt. And they were, again, they were yelling things like, faggot, you know what I mean? Are you a girl? Are you a boy? Are you a man? Are you a woman? Because we had long hair. A lot of us had long hair. The hippies had long hair. And it was the same kind of thing. It makes you wonder about men. Would women have ever done a thing like these people did in Pakistan the other day? Would women have ever done that? If women ran Germany in the 30s, would there have been a Nazi party and a Holocaust and executions of people? If women were in charge of Japan and the United States during the 30s and the early 40s, would there have been a Pearl Harbor? Would there have been bombings of Dresden? Would there have been fire bombings of Tokyo when thousands of children were murdered, incinerated, Hiroshima, Nagasaki? Would all this have happened? I mean, when you think of somebody like Jesus, you think of the fact that he had feminine qualities. And I think a lot of men who are tough guys, you know, it's not politically correct to say this. And, of course, it's not religiously correct. You don't go to a church or you don't talk in your family about this if you're a Catholic or if you're a religious Christian about how you don't really think. I'm sure there are Christians who don't really think that Jesus was a real man. Not a real man, you know. Because it was the Romans were pushing everybody around. And there was an argument back in those days, too. I mean, Jesus had to deal with the people who wanted him dead weren't just the Romans, because he was preaching a kind of sedition. That is to say, in fact, the Romans didn't care what he was doing because he wasn't preaching revolution. Who really got bothered by him were two classes of people back then. The high priests, who were extremely upset with him because he let it out to be, or people claimed for him to be, and he didn't deny it, that he was the Messiah, the Son of God. And they said he wasn't. He wasn't fulfilling the ancient prophecies correctly, so they said he wasn't. And he was a real problem for them, a problem that they would be happy to have out of the way. And the other people who really hated Jesus and who probably would be happy to have had him out of the way too were the revolutionaries. I mean, the Jews there who wanted to get rid of the Romans and overthrow the Romans by violence. And good luck to them, right? you know, this is something that people can understand. I mean, we wanted to get rid of the British, you arrogant, you know, sons of masculine sons of bitches coming over here and taking our taxes, you know, occupying our houses, insulting people, making laws that we didn't agree with, taking away any possibility of freedom, of equality. So, you know, we had to have a revolution. But what if women ran the world? I don't know. Sometimes I keep wondering, you know, what about Gandhi? But you look at Gandhi, you know, he was a man. Yes, he was a man. And he had tremendous courage and fortitude, spent so much time in jail. was locked up so many times and spent a total of years if you added up in jail, and he was this little tiny guy who spoke in a sort of a delicate soft voice, and Jesus is preaching nonviolence, and he was going around forgiving people and saying, let's not throw stones unless we examine ourselves. Let's turn the other cheek. Let the Romans do what they want. We have our own spiritual life, and we have our own hearts to think of. And people like Gandhi and Jesus were considered to be not real men by a lot of people. The people who hated them the most were the ones who were the most committed to violence. And it's a complicated issue. Sometimes it's a question. You go back to these historical contexts, and maybe even now, is there any way to get rid of violent, oppressive people? I mean, the United States in the Middle East, the United States in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq and other places with their fighter bombers and their artillery and their bunker buster bombs and their tremendous amount of weaponry and the things that happened in Afghanistan and Iraq where thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent people and a lot of children were killed by American occupation forces. And then Afghanistan is an ancient problem. I mean, the British and the Russians way back in the mid-1800s and before that were trying to conquer Afghanistan. And these guys have their own, paternalistic tribal ways. Talk about, treating women. It's maybe on a scale of, 1 to 10. You're getting up around a 10 or an 11 when you're dealing with some people, with a lot of the men in some of these Middle Eastern countries. In Saudi Arabia, in Afghanistan, it's really extreme, probably in Pakistan. Wherever there is really fundamentalist religion, any fundamentalist religion like the Orthodox Jews, the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, ultra-Orthodox Jews in this country, the fundamentalist Muslims in a lot of countries who actually comprised the Taliban. The Taliban were people who were, and in Iran and other places, they were stoning. They wanted to stone women to death for committing adultery. They literally, this is the year 2014, it was like a couple of years ago, or maybe even now. And they were, and when the Taliban was in charge in Afghanistan, Jesus, this is the worst example of this patriarchal hatred and brutality and sadism towards women. Why do these men hate women so much? Why do they hate men who act what they would call act in a feminine way? Why do they hate this so much? What kind of threat is this to them? Is it homophobia? I don't know what the problem is. What bothered everybody about Jesus so much? Well, I mean, I told you, in one case, he wasn't fulfilling the religious prophecies and seemed to be claiming he was the Son of God, that is to say, the Messiah, which could have been two separate things. But that's, the Messiah sent by God to be the Savior of the Jews. But this isn't the way that the Messiah had been pictured or was, prophesied in the ancient Holy Land and in the scriptures. The way the Messiah is prophesied is that he will come down and he will kick ass. That's who the Messiah is going to be. This is from, this is from the Middle East. It's from a harsh place. The Messiah, and this is why the high priest didn't like it, that he was claiming to be the Messiah, he was going around acting, like a hippie. He was saying, oh, whatever, man. No, don't do that, man. That's not cool. Don't hit people. Don't stone them. Don't spend your whole life cherishing murder in your heart and wanting to get back and pay back. Love one another. Love one another. This is not the Messiah that is prophesied. The Messiah that is prophesied is a hard-assed, tough guy. He's like an Arnold Schwarzenegger guy. He's like a Sylvester Stallone guy for the Jews. He's going to, jump in a chariot, a blazing chariot, and he's going to lay waste to all the enemies of the Jews. This is who the Messiah is supposed to be. He doesn't go around acting like a hippie. He doesn't go, he doesn't go around forgiving people, and Gandhi, too, But that's a different story in a way, because there's a whole different context there. You're dealing with Hinduism, which is closely related to Buddhism. Actually, Buddhism comes out of Hinduism. the original Buddha himself was you know, a Hindu. But there's this who's a man in India. I'm sure there's plenty of men who consider themselves real men as opposed to women. But the idea of what's masculine in India and what it was like in ancient times in India and wherever Buddha, you know, wandered, it was probably different than the idea of what comes out of the Middle East. But in Afghanistan and in other places, in very fundamentalist Muslim countries, and like I say, also in fundamental Christianity, women have their place. And, you know, in America, it's a complicated thing because women are always fighting for equality. But in fundamentalist sects, you know, the old-fashioned Mormons, and look at in the Catholic Church. The Episcopalians now are fighting over whether women should be bishops, and I think there are some Episcopalians are breaking down now because they would be hypocrites otherwise. A lot of them live in these Western countries where there is equality being elevated in every way, equality in everything except what in the basic religion of these countries, and the Catholic Church, of course, is the big holdout. And the Catholic Church, interesting, whatever harsh, contemptuous, fearfulness about women that migrated from the Middle East and later became the original, you know, Catholic Church in Rome, came from that area originally and migrated there. The Catholic Church are still holdouts, and the Catholic Church still forbids women from, they're not allowed to be priests. And women are considered to be the root of all evil. And women are, and what is it, the sexuality? Is it the gentleness? I mean, and the idea of, I think what one of the problems is it's the sexuality and it's the gentleness of women. Now, obviously, not all women are gentle. And women can cut you up and mow you down in their own special way, but it's usually verbal, right? It's usually verbal. Some women are tough. Some women are violent. But I think that a lot of men are so insecure and so bound in psychological and patriarchal and ancient tribal ways to being the idea of being dominant and being tough based on their own strength and their own power, sheer power and strength, that the idea of being gentle is seen as just being like a woman. And women definitely will tend towards being gentle. That would be their first response. And why that is, I'm sure there are 4 million books written about that. But women could not do what these men did. They wandered through this school and methodically executed children. 5-year-old children, 10-year-old children, 12-year-old children, shot them down. A woman in most places in the world, and especially in those places in the world still, because they are, let's say, behind what we have here, is, you know, a woman is responsible for children in those places. And women, well, think of it, women are the ones who get pregnant. Women are the ones who carry children. They nurture children inside them. They are part of them. Children, for 9 months, this little life is part of a woman. This is why abortion is such a complicated, serious issue. It's not just, you know, having to do with what God said or what the church says. It has to do with, you think women who get abortions do it lightly? I've known women who've had abortions, and it tears them up in a way which sometimes they can't ever forget or they can't ever leave behind them. It's an awful thing. They know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. Some women rationalize it, but a lot of women know just what they're doing. They do it for reasons that are important to them, that are important for their lives, for the lives of their, for the health of their marriage, for the sake of who knows what. But to have an abortion is, for a woman, a tremendous, complex, awful procedure, because they know what they're doing. And women, and especially in this part of the world where these murders happen, they're the ones who take care of children. You know, the ones who are pregnant, they give birth to children through all that pain. They nurse them, they feed them, they care for them every day, every single day, all day long. They protect children, they cook, they play with children, they instruct children. And men are out in the world, and it's a hard world. Men are separate. Men have a certain biological separation from children that women don't have. Having had them be inside them for 9 months, be part of their own bodies, of giving birth to them, of taking care of them in infancy and nursing them and attending to their every need and wearing themselves out taking care of children, there would be no population. We are overpopulated. We are definitely overpopulated on Earth. This is one reason for all the violence. But there would be no human race if it weren't for children. If it wasn't for women taking care of children, because men have a certain kind of, and I'm not saying all men, but this is all completely generalizations, but men have a separation from children because they have not been pregnant, they have not carried them around inside them, they have not nursed them, fed them from their own bodies. So men have this kind of weird separation from children. I don't believe that women could have walked around a school like that and murdered all those children. I don't believe that women could have dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and incinerated thousands of children, or on Dresden and killed children. I don't believe women could have set up concentration camps and murdered hundreds of thousands of children, innocent children, in gas chambers, or shot them in the back of the head like the Nazis did. I don't believe it could happen. I just don't believe it can happen. And men have this weird, it's a hard, tough world. And men are the ones who generally, and this has been going on since cave times, right? Since prehistory, men are the ones who have to go out in the world and fight and bring down the animals, right? These big, and they're bigger and stronger, and there's reasons for this, right? The ones who have to run after them and bring them down and kill them and drag them back to the cave, right? Men are the ones who have to fight each other for territory when other caves and other tribes are invading and trying to steal their women and children and trying to murder them all and have dominance over them. Men are the ones who do this fighting. Men, most of all, go out in the world. I mean, in the modern world, it's all jumbled and complex. But in a place like the Middle East, especially in Afghanistan or Pakistan, it's the same as it was in some ways thousands of years ago. It's men who have to do all this hard work. But what happens? What happens that men are able to go around and execute children? It's something I just don't understand. Well, Christmas is coming up, and every year the mythology of and the message of Christ being reborn is the message of get rid of the payback, get rid of the revenge, and bring the gentleness and bring the love into your life than the way you treat other people. And that way, maybe you'll enter the kingdom of heaven. That's something that you could believe in.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, we sweet the sound that saves.